Menopause, perimenopause, these can be some of the most uncomfortable phases of a woman's life. If you find yourself in either of these, well, Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it really shows.
And get this, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it is perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold.
And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
Saving money on exterior wall lights now at Menards. Find your style with Patriot Lighting. Exterior lights enhance the look of your home. Choose from over 50 options from Patriot Lighting. Now through May 19th, get $10 instant savings on a single qualifying purchase of $100 or more on in-stock outdoor wall lights. Check out our entire selection of outdoor lights and see the rest of our deals happening now on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Dress, the history of fashion, is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Dress listeners, today we pick back up the story we began weaving earlier this week about the devastating fire which claimed the lives of 146 garment workers in Lower Manhattan on March 25th, 1911. And as we approach the 113th anniversary of one of the most deadly workplace accidents in American history, we continue to take a look at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire and the sweeping changes in workers' rights and labor reforms that the fire helped usher into law.
And dress listeners, before we can get to the protections the tragedy spawned, we need to examine the events of the day itself. And on Wednesday's episode, we spoke about the exploitative labor practices made possible by the lack of regulation within New York City's garment trades. And of course, this is during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. We also spoke about some of the turn of the century efforts to unionize garment factories with the aims of establishing workplace protections, as well as reasonable working hours and wages. So if you have not already listened to part one, you probably want to listen to that episode first because it really sets the scene and provides context for the events we are about to discuss today.
And just a little heads up here, friends, we are going to hear testimony, the words from some of those survivors of the Triangle Factory fire, as well as perhaps from some of the first responders to the scene. So if you are sensitive to these matters or if somebody listening with you might be triggered by this type of testimony to loss, please be aware that this episode does contain some graphic descriptions of the loss of life. Okay, so earlier this week, we left off speaking about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, which was Manhattan's largest shirtwaist or waist manufacturer in 1911. So for those of you unfamiliar with this term, shirtwaist, it's a little bit of a like now lesser used term for a blouse. And these shirtwaists were a part of the core everyday look of most women's wardrobes at this time. And this look was a combination of a sweeping floor-length skirt and a cotton or perhaps linen blouse, aka a shirtwaist, which could be embellished with an infinite variety of pleats, tucks, bits of lace, ruffles, or various other trimmings. And whether it was worn with or without a jacket, the shirtwaist was foundational to women's fashion at this time, especially American women's fashion. And most women, regardless of class, would have owned several shirtwaists, if not maybe even dozens.
It was the t-shirt of the early 1900s.
Exactly.
Given its predominance in women's wardrobes at this time, it's perhaps not surprising that by the 1910s, an estimated 500 shirtwaist factories were operating in Manhattan, and they employed an estimated 40,000 garment workers. the vast majority of whom, about 75% of these workers, were young immigrant women between the ages of 13 and 30. And these garment workers were young and eager to contribute to their family's welfare, and that put them in vulnerable positions to be exploited by unscrupulous employers who looked to maximize profits by manipulating their wages and cutting corners when it came to workplace safety.
And on this point of workplace safety, that is where we really launch into our episode today. The events of Saturday, March 25th, 1911, have been called, quote, the fire that changed America, as political and legislative fallout in the wake of the disaster led to sweeping changes to industrial safety code enforcement and widespread labor reform. Okay, so what exactly happened that day, Cass, and where?
Okay, so we are going to set the scene, which is Lower Manhattan and the neighborhood of Greenwich Village. Specifically, we are going to be looking at the Ash Building, which was and continues to be located at the intersection of Green Street and Washington Square Place. And this is just off Washington Square Park and adjacent to New York University's Silver Center for Arts and Sciences, as well as several other New York University properties clustering the two-block radius. So by all accounts, it was a beautiful sunny day in New York City, and the Ash Building was sparsely populated late on a Saturday afternoon, except for, of course, for the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, which occupied the top three floors of the building. The company's workrooms occupied the 8th and 9th floors, while the corporate offices took up the 10th.
And I would like to chat here a little bit about how the workrooms were set up, as ultimately this will kind of play into how the tragedy unfolded. The Ash Building was largely set up as an industrial loft building with these really wide open floor plans that tenants could subdivide as they wished. And in the case of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, which could employ anywhere between 500 to 600 garment workers per day, these workrooms were left more or less wide open, except for these little walled partition areas at the front of each floor that had a cloakroom and a toilet.
So occupying the majority of these floors were 7 to 8 very, very long continuous tables, which stretched from the southern wall of the room to nearly the north wall, where there was just enough room that was left for a walkable passage to the stairs, freight elevator, and fire escape, which was on the north side of the building. And we need to stress here that these tables did not have breaks between them. They were very long and really restrictive as to how employees could move about the space. So on the 9th floor, these tables held approximately 240 sewing machines, while on the 8th floor, the long tables were half used as cutting tables and the other half had additional sewing machines.
And underneath those cutting tables on the 8th floor were these very, very large wooden bins into which the cutters, who were the makers responsible for cutting the shirtwaist fabric out from patterns, the cutters tossed the scraps of leftover fabric waste into the bins. So at any given time, there could be hundreds and hundreds of pounds of fabric scraps in these bins. And that's because the Triangle Factory churned out somewhere between 10,000 and 12,000 shirt waists per
week. Whoa, it's a lot of shirt waists.
That's just this one factory. And then the other thing that we really need to mention here is that suspended above many of the cutting tables were the tissue paper patterns that were used in the cutting process. And these were dangling from wires from the ceiling, and they were kept there because this arrangement gave cutters very easy access to the necessary tools to maximize their efficiency, which at this time was of prime importance. And as we discussed in our last episode, many of these garment workers were actually assigned quotas for their work, and their pay depended on reaching those quotas. So having one's tools and implements at hand was crucial for cutters. And we just want to emphasize once again that those long tables, which really spanned the room, greatly restricted everyone's circulation, ability to walk and circulate around the space.
And speaking of the cutters, on that fated day of March 25th, 1911, one such cutter, Isidor Abramovitz, at approximately 4:40 p.m., was preparing to leave for the day, and he noticed a small fire in his scrap bin. And Isidor and others quickly rushed to fill fire pails kept on hand for this purpose because it was not the first fire the factory had experienced, it must be said. But this one in particular really took on a life of its own very quickly. And it seemed that the water that was dousing the scrap bins was only making things worse. And some have speculated that many of the rags in the bins were soaked in oily substances used to lubricate the sewing machines. You know, water rarely quells any oil fire. And in some cases, water causes it to actually spread. So this seems to have been the case the day of the Triangle Fire, as the fire in the bins was undeterred by the water in the fire pails. And a small selection of men attempted to engage a fire hose mounted on the wall in the 8th floor stairwell with no luck, because the hose would not fill because it lacked the necessary water pressure. And the team trying to extinguish the fire was left with this meager amount of small red fire pails kept on the factory floor.
As the flames in the scrap bins grew and leapt vertically, suddenly the tissue paper patterns suspended above the tables caught ablaze, any garments in the area caught ablaze, and these wispy embers began circulating around the room, catching the other scrap bins on fire as well. So the room was basically very rapidly engulfed in fire from the ceiling above and also from the scrap bins below. And as one can imagine, terror quickly spread amongst the employees, who quickly realized that the fire was not going to be contained. And rushing for an exit, many were impeded by the long tables within the room, as well as this partition wall that blocked the main rear exit. And this partition wall had been installed there for the purposes of funneling employees through like a checkpoint or an inspection point, where a guard was always posted to inspect employees' bags before they left the factory in order to prevent theft.
Triangle Fire survivor Mary Domsky Abrams later recalled, quote, "We considered it to be the greatest insult to have to open our pocketbooks and show that we weren't stealing anything. The bosses said this was necessary because the workers brought along these pocketbooks with the intention of slipping out some wastes. The fact was that even if the workers had wanted to steal anything, it would have been impossible because when bundles of work were distributed, every item was counted and listed on the tickets. And when the work was completed, everything was counted again."
And this very particular inspection process of checking people's bags is mentioned time and time again by survivors of the fire. Eighth floor worker Matt Hochfeld recalled, quote, "There were two exits, but they kept the," and he's referring to the front one, "the front door locked. Because every night when we went home, each girl had to open her pocketbook, showing the man that she didn't steal any lace or trimmings." So the fact of the matter is that the ash building did have a set of elevators and stairs at both the front. So an elevator and stairs at the front, and also an elevator and stairs at the rear of the building. But in the words of survivor Rose Hauer, quote, "We were never allowed to go down the front way, either by elevator or staircase. We always went by the freight, which was in the back."
And this is the point in the episode where we should probably prepare many of you to get upset or angry, because in order to facilitate this inspection theft prevention process, Triangle management kept one of the two mandated staircase exits locked. So while the elevator operators valiantly attempted to take as many people down as possible, and a bottleneck of workers jammed the unlocked rear staircase, as the fire spread, any workers caught in the front of the 8th floor where the staircase was locked were in serious trouble.
Again, Mary Domsky Abrams, quote, "My own machine was located near the locked front doors, and I often looked with fear at the darkness that loomed through the half-glass door, which made me feel as if some secret force was peering out from there. And it was before this door that the greatest number of victims were caught. They had surged to the door hoping to escape, but couldn't break through because the door was always securely locked."
Awful, awful, awful. So meanwhile, 8th floor clerk Dinah Lipschitz attempted to alert the two floors above the rapidly spreading inferno. Her attempt to alert the 10th floor via a device called a telautograph, which is essentially a forerunner of the fax machine, went unnoticed, and her calls to the 10th floor switchboard were not immediately answered. The cause and effect of these communication failures meant that while the 8th floor employees had somewhat of a head start in escaping the fire as it grew, the 9th floor workers had practically no notice whatsoever.
9th floor worker Rose Hauer recalled, upon preparing to leave for the day, She went to gather her things in the cloakroom and then said, quote, "When I got out of the dressing room, I looked towards the freight elevator and I saw smoke pouring up. The smoke was also coming out of the staircase. I ran with some of the other girls to the front door. I tried my hand on the knob and I tried to open it and I stood there screaming that the door was locked. I tried to force it open with all my strength, but it would not move."
And Rose continued, "I looked around and I saw the flames coming in all the windows. The fire was in the shop and was coming towards us. There was a fire escape at the windows near the freight side. The fire escapes had iron doors and shutters. Everybody was running and hollering and people were choking from the heavy smoke. I took my muff and put it over my head. I ran back to the front elevator and there was no chance there. I kept my muff on my head and ran toward the freight side again. I found that the door to the back staircase was open and that is how I got out. Before I went down the staircase, I looked to the fire escape. I saw one woman climb on there and fall right over the rail."
Very sadly, the big picture here is, dress listeners, that many of these egress routes or escape routes by which Triangle employees were meant to exit the building in case of a fire, precisely such as this, well, these egress routes failed them. And this also includes the very meager fire escape. And particularly on the 8th floor where the fire started, some people didn't even know it was there. Sylvia Klemmendorf later recalled, quote, "I did not go to the fire escape because I didn't even know that there was a fire escape." And this is because there had never been any sort of fire safety training whatsoever for these factory employees. 20 or so people did manage to find their way to the fire escape, but it failed them regardless because it was flimsy, it was in disrepair, and the fire escape twisted under their weight and basically detached itself from the building, sending all 20 plus souls crashing to their deaths.
If things were going horrifically for the 8th floor workers, on the 9th floor, things were even more gruesome. Most were caught entirely off guard, and by the time they were even aware of the fire, the 9th floor rear staircase and elevator were unusable as they were engulfed in toxic black smoke. 9th floor forewoman Anne Padone recalled, quote, "Suddenly someone ran to the dressing room and cried fire. I came out of the dressing room and saw everything was in flames. I ran to the front door and the door was locked. Many people began to go to the windows to jump from the windows, and the people began to throw themselves out of the windows. All the machines were bubbling with flames."
So this disturbing scene is recounted by witness after witness testifying to the carnage of the fire that day. There were these dozens and dozens and dozens of people trapped on the 9th floor, and a lot of them made this terrifying decision to leap to their deaths rather than be burned alive.
And while the fire department worked as quickly as they could to rig hoses and raise ladders, it was an uphill battle because their rescue ladders only reached the 6th floor, while the stream of their hoses only reached the 7th floor. And from the street, there was little the firemen could do except span rescue nets and hope of catching some of the workers who jumped. But the nets did little good as the velocity of the falls was so great the nets simply ripped.
Yeah, and out there, there are copious amounts of primary source testimony as to the horror of this day. But Cass and I made the decision to not really explicitly detail some of the more macabre and gruesome aspects of the tragedy. Let's just let this speak for itself. One seasoned veteran of the New York Police Force, who was on the scene at the time, told reporters for the New York Times that the dozens of victims falling from the sky was, quote, "the worst thing I ever saw." So, we're going to say no more on that, but some of the online resources that we are going to link to in our show notes have oral histories from first responders and also survivors of the fire. So if you would like to read about some of this in their words, those accounts are available online. One thing that we will say, however, is that it was rather a bit of a challenge in the wake of the fire to identify many of the 146 victims. Their bodies were brought to the Charities Pier to await identification by their families and loved ones. And sometimes it was an unscathed shoe or other garment that was a clue to the victim's identity. Some victims were actually identified by their pay stubs remaining in their pockets because it had been payday the day of the fire. Some others were identified by jewelry, and a shocking number of those pieces of jewelry were engagement rings. And given the age demographic of its largely female workforce, that makes sense. The majority of the women that were killed in the fire were in their teens and 20s. And out of the 146 people who perished that day, all but 21 of the victims were women. Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Dress listeners, did you know that you can save on everything from fashion to beauty, home decor to groceries, even kids' school supplies with Rakuten?
Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. Beauty, clothing, electronics, home, department stores, pets, you name it. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while doing it? It really is a no-brainer.
How does it work, you ask? Well, stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via a check or PayPal quarterly.
Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. So join the 17 million members who have already saved at their favorite brands. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. That's Rakuten.com.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples. Dress listeners, if you suffer from seasonal allergies like me, Astapro is your new go-to. It has been super helpful to me this spring as it bursts into full bloom.
And that's because Astapro is the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter solution for nasal allergy symptoms. Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours.
Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray, and Astapro delivers full prescription strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing. You too can get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief like I have with Astapro. It gets me back in the game, ready to record the show for all of you.
Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can Astapro and go today. That's Astepro allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies. In just 30 minutes, what would remain the deadliest workplace incident in New York City for the next 90 years, and that is until the terrorist attacks at the World Trade Center in 2001 was over. So approximately one quarter of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory's staff perished that fateful day, largely the employees of the 8th and 9th floors, because the majority of the 10th floor staff, including the Triangle Factory owners, Max Blank and Isaac Harris, escaped to the building's roof and scampered over other adjoining rooftops to safety. Given the extremely public nature of the disaster, press coverage the following day was extensive, including a very lengthy article in the New York Times which quotes New York City's coroner, Holzhauser, who lambasted the lack of safety measures in place at the factory, including the failure of the fire escape. Quote, "And only one miserable little fire escape. I shall proceed against the building department along with the others. They are as guilty as any. They haven't been insistent enough, and those poor girls who were carried up in the elevator to work in the morning, now they come on the end of a rope."
Coroner Holzhauser was not the only outraged party. Public sentiment swung from grief to anger as the story of the locked stairwell doors became public knowledge, as well as the fact that the fire that day was far from Triangle's first. They had had at least three previous fires that had occurred in the workroom floors, and yet the owners continued to flout fire codes again and again. And Blank and Harris would quickly become public pariahs. The public was calling for justice, especially when it became known. As the fire chief Croker told the New York Times, quote, "The large loss of life is due to neglect." Ultimately, the source of the spark that set the bin on fire has never been exactly firmly established, but it is now assumed that it was probably an unextinguished match or cigarette. As get this, Cass, this is unthinkable to me. Smoking on the factory floors was permitted, and even after the Triangle factory fire, it still continued to be legal. Now, did some of the labor reformers say, hey, we suggest that you don't let your employees smoke on the factory floor? It was a suggestion. It never was like legislation, at least for a while. So,
and this also speaks to that gendered practice of smoking at this time, because it's not the women employees who are being allowed to smoke. It's the male managers, et cetera, who are being allowed to smoke, who caused this fire, because I promise you those women were not allowed to have cigarettes at this time on the factory floor. So I digress. Collectively, New York City's citizens mourned the loss of some of its most vulnerable citizens, particularly the Garment Workers Union that had been working so diligently to protect its members. You might remember we talked about that on Wednesday's episode. 10 days after the fire, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union organized a funeral procession in New York City streets. Despite the cold and the rain, an estimated 120,000 people marched in this procession, while another 300,000 lined the streets to watch. In an article published in the journal Life and Labor, author Martha Bensley Brewer wrote of witnessing this procession, and she said, "As I write, the morning procession moves past in the rain. For 2 hours, they have been going steadily by, and the end is not yet in sight. There have been no carriages, no imposing marshals on horseback, just thousands and thousands of working men and women carrying the banners of their trade through the long 3-mile tramp in the rain. Never have I seen a military pageant or triumphant ovation so impressive, for it is not because 146 workers were killed in the Triangle shop, not altogether. It is because every year there are 50,000 working men and women killed in the United States, 136 a day, almost as many as happened to be killed together on the 25th of March, and because slowly, very slowly, it is dawning on these thousands on thousands that such things do not have to be."
And, shockingly, in the same article, Brewer noted, quote, "Harris and Blank, the Triangle Company owners, have offered to pay 1 week's wages to the families of the dead girls, as though it were summer and they had given them a vacation. 3 days after the fire, they inserted in the trade papers this notice. Notice, the Triangle Waste Company begged to notify their customers that they are in good working order. Headquarters is now at 9 to 11 University Place. The day after they were installed in their new quarters, the building department of New York City discovered that 9 to 11 University Place was not even fireproof, that the firm had already blocked exits to the only one fire escape by placing 2 rows of sewing machines," end quote. This is literally days after the Triangle factory fire. They were already up to it again.
Yeah. And while Blank and Harris would soon face criminal charges for the locked doors, which survivors of the fire testified would have saved the majority of the lives lost during the Triangle fire, the so-called Shirtwaist Kings duo did little to change their ways, which is just awful. Those of you who have heard part one of this episode will recall that Blank and Harris owned several other waste factories in Manhattan, and subsequent inspections of them for safety violations also revealed that these leopards did not change their spots year in and year out. And not just in 1911, there's a 1913 New York Times article that cites them again for fire safety violations. So they had fire exits that were blocked, and there was also a 6-foot-high pile of paper rubbish, which factory owners claimed, quote, represented the sweepings of the previous hour and that it was about to be collected in cans and disposed of. And again, people are smoking on that floor, right?
Yeah. 6 feet high. 6 feet high stack of paper. Okay. This callous approach to worker safety is appalling, obviously. But perhaps Harris and Blank felt they were above the law entirely. And I guess in many ways they were, because as shocking as all of this may to be to us today, they were actually acquitted in the cases for both manslaughter and safety violations, which were quickly brought against them by the district attorney's office in April of 1911. The only legal troubles the duo actually ultimately faced were a series of 23 civil cases brought against them for the loss of life by families of some of the victims, just a sliver of the victims. And these cases were ultimately settled several years later in 1914, with Blank and Harris paying the victims' families a sum of $75 each at the time, which would have been barely over $2,300 today. That is horrific and insulting.
And while these particular families received restitution from the factory owners, whose negligence and greed was responsible for their loved ones' loss, and of course no price can be put on that, right? Many other families also received support from various other sources, including the Women's Trade Union League and various other Jewish community organizations, which formed a joint relief committee with the American Red Cross, who administered what would be, in total, approximately $1 million today to the families of the victims. So this worked out to be around $6,000 per life lost, with if all of the families received equal compensation.
And that's if all families received compensation. And that is a little bit unclear. So charitable organizations were actually not the only ones to take up a vested interest in the wake of the fire. So also did the government. In the fall of 1911, the New York legislature formed the Factory Investigation Committee, which, according to the New York State Archives, was, quote, charged with investigating factory sanitary and safety conditions, wages, and other related issues such as the living conditions of workers. The commission appointed directors for each investigation, and field agents were hired to carry out on-site inspections of factories and other work sites. Additionally, from its studies of the deficiency in the labor law, the commission concluded that the entire law needed reworking and that the Department of Labor should be reorganized. So when we're saying that this fire sparked sweeping changes, this is what we're talking about.
Again, from the New York State Archives records on the Factory Investigation Committee, quote, work continued through 1913 on investigation of fire, safety, and health conditions, their proposed recodification of the labor law, a study of duplicative building inspection functions, and other studies such as one concerning prison contract labor in shirt manufacturing. The commission's work resulted in more legislation in 1914, including laws relating to sanitary conditions and women and children's working hours in stores.
Yeah, and I think in 1914 alone, something like 35 individual reform laws were put in place. So this is a lot of change, right? And pushing this much change through the New York State Legislature was no easy feat at this time. There's a lot out there that has been written about the political machine of Tammany Hall at this time, which ruled New York City's Democratic Party. And without the blessing of Tammany Hall politicians, it was extremely difficult to effect change in the matters of administration of New York City. So leading the lobbying charges and these committee changes were two notable figures that I think we need to acknowledge today. The first one is State Assemblyman Al Smith, who has been called the, quote, hero of the New York labor reform movement. And Smith was an exceptionally dedicated member of the Factory Investigation Committee. And it is said that he never missed an opportunity to go on one of these in-person inspections of a factory, and that he was exceptionally passionate in his role of not only observer and agent of oversight, but also his other role in actually fighting to turn progressive labor concepts into law.
And there's another notable figure that we definitely want to mention who was committed to industrial safety reform in the wake of the fire, and that was Frances Perkins, who was only 30 years old when she was nominated to the state's Committee for Safety. And Perkins was a tireless advocate of labor reform for factory workers. She would go on to serve as the United States Secretary of Labor from 1933 to 1945. And the collective impact of Smith and Perkins cannot be overstated in terms of our modern system of rules, regulations, and oversight of workers' rights and safety here in the United States. And in 1911, Dr. George M. Price, M.D., the chairman of the Executive Committee of the Joint Board of Sanitary Control in the Cloak and Suit Industry of New York, was quoted in an issue of the journal The Ladies' Garment Worker as saying, Americans need big shocks, meaning they needed to be shocked into meaningful action, And the Triangle Factory Fire was one such event that shocked the nation, or as author David Vondrell has called it, the fire that changed America. And of course, they're referring to this event had to happen for labor reform to happen, which is awful, but clearly people finally sat up and noticed. And April, I was just curious, do you know what happened to the owners of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory before we move on?
Ultimately, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, I think, went out of business in something like 1917. But where they ended up later in their days, I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, I feel like I read somewhere, too, that they, after they paid those lawsuits or whatever, that they finally had to shut the doors. But then they just went and lived their lives, right? So it doesn't feel like they ever really had to have accountability for their actions.
No, and as far as everything that I've read, they were never repentant about it at all. I don't know if they ever even issued a single apology. Yeah. So maybe somebody who has studied this a little bit more in depth has a better answer to that. And if you have, let us know.
Well, and I think it's really interesting too. This is really just a case study, right? And not just, it's not unique to garment manufacturing. This is like an insight into the plight and conditions of all working class people at this time in the United States, overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. So.
And a lot of these labor reform laws that we've kind of been referring to loosely, they didn't impact only the garment factory workers. It was factory-wide. So it was the garment factory that spurred on all of these other factory workers' rights as well. Okay. All of this being said, Cass, even today, ridding the American garment trades of all evils is a task that is far from complete. According to Cornell University, quote, recent studies conducted by the U.S. Department of Labor found that 67% of Los Angeles garment factories and 63% of New York garment factories violate minimum wage and overtime laws. 98% of Los Angeles garment factories have workplace health and safety problems serious enough to lead to severe injuries or death, end quote. And in 2021, CBS News actually published a piece, and the piece was specifically about the rates paid for piecework in some of the LA factories, which were as low as 5 to 6 cents per piece.
Wow.
Dress listeners, as expected, our annual Fashion History Tour of Paris sold out in a matter of a few days. But for any of you who may have wanted to join but hadn't just yet, all may not be lost.
That's right, because we are actually considering adding a second week of our exploration of the City of Lights from October 12th to the 19th of this year. So you can join us on this behind-the-scenes tour of Parisian fashion and fashion history as we take you on exclusive tours of the world's most important fashion museums. We visit the private ateliers of Paris's finest makers, and we even have the rare opportunity to wander the close-to-the-public palatial home of one of Paris's most fashionable courtesans, La Païva, which was actually a new addition to last year that everyone absolutely loved.
And Cass and I cannot wait to lead you to some of the best vintage shopping in Paris. Oh, and did we mention a visit to Versailles and Marie Antoinette's Petit Trianon, where she famously kept her flock of pink-dyed sheep?
Which is absolutely a highlight always, as is our private after-hours tour of the Paris Opera, which takes us to the ballet's costume workshops and into the underbelly of the opera house, where we learn why it was famously the inspiration for the Phantom of the Opera.
And we'll meet textile experts, haute couture embroiderers, and museum curators all along the way. So bienvenue à Paris this October 12th through 19th. Head over to the tours page of dresshistory.com for a detailed itinerary and to register your interest in a potential second week. That's dresshistory.com/tours.
And when you start doing the math on this, dress listeners, one begins to question if we have come all that far at all, right? So according to Marissa Nuncio, director of the advocacy group, the Garment Workers Center, as a result, workers' average hourly rate last year ranged from $5.85 to as low as $2.68. Nuncio says, quote, at those low rates, they can never reach the minimum wage. It's just impossible. Even the most seasoned, skilled worker cannot possibly sew fast enough. At that rate, to make the LA minimum wage of $15 an hour, a worker paid 5 cents per piece would have to sew 300 pieces in an hour.
And this is exactly what we were talking about before when we were talking about that difference between an hourly rate or a weekly rate and that piece rate.
Yes.
And it's they're just like manipulating it all the time to whatever is the factory owner's advantage. And also, too, let's remember, friends, that we're talking about this happening in LA and New York, in the US, where we actually have legal recourse to prevent and correct labor abuses and these types of violations. Many countries in the world simply do not have these protections in place or do not have the resources to enforce the laws in place effectively. And the result has been this myriad of horrific garment industry disasters all around the world, several in the last few years. Probably the most memorable in recent history is the deadly garment factory disaster, which occurred in Bangladesh in 2013, which still to this day remains the deadliest garment factory disaster in history.
Yeah, so 100 years later, and it's the same game. More than 1,100 garment workers lost their lives on April 24th, 2013, when the Rana Plaza building collapsed. This building was home to 5 garment factories on the upper floors, while shops and a bank occupied the lower levels. So the day prior to the building's structural collapse, perilous cracks had been found in the building, and the building cleared a safety precaution. And while a majority of employers of the establishment on the lower levels heeded the warnings of architectural peril, the garment workers employed on the upper floors were ordered back to work the next day. And at 9 a.m., the building collapsed, killing 1,134 workers and injuring another 2,500 people.
I remember when this happened very vividly.
Yes.
Yeah. The backlash around the world was swift. Had we not witnessed this before, everyone was saying. So for their part, the Bangladeshi government charged 38 persons with murder, including the building's owner, Sohel Rana, who attempted to avoid arrest for 4 days before he was finally captured in a very dramatic SWAT team situation. And his legal battle over these charges waged on for the next 10 years. And less than a year ago, in April of 2023, he was simply granted bail and released from prison. And the status of this case currently is very, very unclear because it would seem that he was never actually formally sentenced. And then after 10 years, he was just simply released.
Were hoping people weren't paying attention anymore. But there are entire watch groups now. And of course, you've heard us talk about this on the show. There are watch groups that are out there watching these factories, watching this industry, and keeping an eye on this because, case in point, otherwise, if no one's looking, people will just continue. Because this really begs the question, how far have we really come? Yes, modern day sweatshops might be the exception, not the rule in the United States, but they still exist here. And they probably would exist in greater numbers had we not shipped 97% of our garment manufacturing overseas over the past 50 or so years. And let's not forget to look at the bigger picture here, because American consumers specifically are the driving force behind the global fashion manufacturing machine that produces 100 billion garments a year. So yes, we might have workplace protections in place for our workers in the US, but what about the millions of people around the world subject to greed, negligence, and abuse just so that we in the US can afford a $5 t-shirt, right? Our hands are dirty too, my friends, which is why April and I are so passionate about having an ethics and sustainability platform on this podcast about fashion history. It's so easy to romanticize the lessons of history as remaining firmly in the past, but the truth is there's always a connecting thread between the past, present, and future, and we have so much to learn from history, especially about that relationship between the manufacturing of clothing and human rights abuses. These two things go together like a needle and thread.
So today, 113 years later, we remember and honor the 146 souls that perished on that fateful day in March of 1911. People should not die so that we can wear and afford clothing. And that is a lesson that is important today as ever. Again, in the words of Triangle Factory fire survivor Mary Domsky Abrams, quote, "That spring of 1911, we mourned our dead comrades, the victims of a society which was concerned with only the profits of an individual and not the welfare of the many of the working masses. The Triangle victims were martyrs in the fight for social justice, and the labor movement will always remember them as those who, with their young lives, paved the way for a better world with a more just society, a world free from exploitation, in which equal rights for all will be respected," end quote.
Dress listeners, this has really been only a cursory overview of the Triangle Factory disaster and its lasting impact on labor reform and workplace protections over the last 100 years. As we mentioned in part one of this episode, if you want to learn more, there are also many books written by scholars who have studied the fire's lasting impact on the garment industry, and they've studied it from different angles like women's studies, labor reform, macroeconomics. There are several feature-length documentaries on the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, as well as various print and online resources, and a really, really fantastic website as well by Cornell University, which we will link to. And I really love that website, April. I'm sure you spent time on it, but it identifies each and every one of the victims, tells you who mm-hmm. they are, tells you how old they were, where they came from.
And their address in New York City. And very interestingly enough, one of them lived directly across the street from the building that I live in now.
Wow.
My street number is 123. And her street number was 124. So she literally lived right across the street. I think this year that I might do a little sidewalk chalk, little memorial for her. Also, address listeners, please know if you happen to be in New York City, you can also participate in person this March 25th in a commemoration of the fire at the Ash Building, which was, of course, the site of the fire. This is now home to an incredible memorial to the lives lost. It is this stainless steel ribbon sculpture that runs up the facade of the building and it reaches into the sky to the ninth floor where the loss of life was the greatest. And there's all these other elements to the memorial that allow the name of each victim of the disaster to be reflected in light onto this glass panel that's at hip height, like that goes around the exterior of the building. So this is a fairly new memorial, or it was finally completed, reached its final phase of completion not that long ago. It was dedicated in October of 2023. I think I mentioned this in one of our Fashion History Now episodes. But also, I will post a video for the dedication ceremony of the memorial in our show notes because it features lots and lots of speeches by contemporary labor activists who reflect on the legacy of the fire today.
On that note, dress listeners, we will leave you this week to ponder the role you would like social justice to play in your wardrobe next time you get dressed. As always, we love hearing from you, so please email us at hello@dressedhistory.com, or you can DM us at dressed_podcast, which is where we post images to accompany each week's episodes. If you'd like to search for Instagram content connected specifically to this week's episodes, check out the hashtag dressed352 and dressed353.
Dress listeners, just a few weeks left until we launch our newest Dress the School of Fashion offering, which is the first installation of our Great Designer series. This launches on April 6th with a 4-part class, Euro-American Fashions Innovators and Icons, Part 1, taught by me. And you can learn more about this and how to register at dressedhistory.com, which is where you can also sign up for one of my ongoing private fashion history tours of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. I've done several of these now. Tons of dress listeners have been coming. They're super fun. And I'll be expanding offerings of these types of tours this spring.
You know what else we are offering? Our dress bookshelf. Head on over to bookshop.org/shop/dress to check out 120 of our favorite and featured fashion history titles. We also provide a link to that in our show notes. We love the fact that bookshop.org works with independent booksellers to source their offerings. Also, you have heard us say it, but we will say it again. Dress listeners, you can listen to Dressed ad-free for just $3 a month. You can skip the ads, and you can find a link to that in our show notes as well. Thank you, as always, for tuning in, and more Dressed coming your way on Wednesday. Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.